recommended.
Thanks. Okay, so this talk will have almost nothing to do with string theory, except from the fact that I will eventually assume the existence of at least one extra dimension. So you may or may not want to relate this to string theory. And it's going to be quite phenomenological. So let me start with a list of four major puzzles in cosmology. Each of them is related to a given value of a component omega. So I remind you that omega is the contribution to the total energy density of a given component I, expressed in units of the critical energy density, which is the energy density for a flat universe. Okay, yes. Sorry. So the fact that omega total is approximately 1 means that the universe is almost flat. And this is telling us, well, at least one of the most elegant solutions to this problem is provided by inflation. And then we have to ask, what is the dynamics responsible for inflation? Who is the inflaton, etc.? Then there is another puzzle associated to the value of omega lambda. So this is telling us that essentially 2/3 of the energy density of the universe is in the form of a component which we call dark energy and which corresponds to a component with a negative pressure. So I'm not going to talk about these two problems since, well, we don't have any answer yet, and it seems that solutions to this problem will probably involve some major steps in our understanding of fundamental physics. However, there are two puzzles which can be answered in a much more modest way. And these are the omega B and omega M puzzles. So omega B is to understand why the contributions from baryons has such value. I remind you that this value essentially has been measured in two independent ways. One way is from Big Bang nucleosynthesis, and the other one is from CMB, essentially the relative difference between if you look at the heights of the two first peaks of the CMB, you can have a measurement of the quantity of baryons in the universe. So the puzzle here is to understand why this number is essentially this, which is 9 orders of magnitude larger than the value you would observe if the universe was symmetric in matter and antimatter. If you were to compute the radic density of baryons in a universe which is symmetric in matter and antimatter, you will find something like this. And the fact that we find such a big number is telling us that the universe is matter-antimatter asymmetric, because essentially at some point the baryons cannot find any antibaryons to annihilate with. Okay, and now omega matter is of order 1/3, and the difference between these two numbers is telling us that matter is not made, I mean, the major part of matter is not made of baryons, so what is it made of? And this is a problem of dark matter. So it turns out that particle physics can solve essentially this problem. They cannot be solved within the standard model. However, minimal extension of the standard model can solve this problem. And the interesting thing is that new physics at the electroweak scale can solve, well, it's very likely that these two problems are related to physics at the weak scale. It's not so clear for baryogenesis, but there are strong hints that the solution to the dark matter puzzle is related to electroweak physics. And this is what I want to emphasize today. Okay, so the natural question to ask is, now that we know that neutrinos have a mass, is why is dark matter not made of neutrinos? And essentially, there are two good reasons. So this is the formula for the prediction of the contributions to the energy density of the universe coming from neutrinos. And here I express the product omega times h squared, where h is the expansion rate of the universe expressed in units of 100 kilometers per second per megaparsec. And h is equal to 0.7. So The reason why neutrinos cannot account for dark matter is that neutrinos correspond to hot dark matter, and this is bad for structure formation. The reason is that essentially a neutrino background would dump any density contrast on small scales. And if you study how structures form in a universe which is dominated by hot dark matter, you would find that big structures form first. So essentially, you would form a supercluster, and then the small structures are formed by fragmentation of large scales. While we know that galaxies are older than clusters, so essentially small structure formed first. So this excludes hot dark matter as a major component of dark matter. And now searches essentially focus on cold dark matter candidates. And you have actually a bound on the neutrino mass from large-scale structure surveys. And this is quite interesting. And it puts a bound on omega nu h squared, which is this quite small number. If you want to forget this cosmological consideration, you can just use the experimental data from neutrino oscillations to get a bound on omega nu h squared. Sorry, this is quite ugly, but for example, from neutrino-less double beta decay, you get a bound on the mass of on the scale of neutrino masses, and you find that omega nu h squared cannot be larger than this number. So if neutrinos cannot account for the major, cannot account for dark matter, then we have to find a stable particle, some new particle to account for dark matter. So the issue is to find a stable particle. So at this point, there are two major classes of possibilities. The first class corresponds to particles which almost do not interact with the standard model. And in this case, the decay rate of this particle is very small, and the particle is stable on cosmological scales. So in this class, the particle never reached thermal equilibrium. So the prediction of the relic density of this particle is not generic. I mean, it's going to be very model dependent. It will depend on the reheat temperature, on the details of very primordial cosmology.
So an axion scale?
Yes. And the second class corresponds to particles which are coupled to the standard model. So in this case, there must be a symmetry to guarantee stability. But the nice thing in this case is that if the particle is at thermal equilibrium, then the prediction for the relic density is quite generic. And what you find is that there's a contribution from this particle to omega is inversely proportional to the annihilation cross-section. And now if you ask, what is the annihilation cross-section I need in order to obtain an omega, which is one-third, the interesting thing is that the annihilation cross-section has to be a weak cross-section. So a particle which has electroweak interactions and which has a mass around 100 GeV will have the annihilation cross-section you need to account for omega of order one. So this is quite remarkable point.
And you got the density, the primordial density from some thermal consideration.
Yeah, so you assume the particle is at thermal equilibrium, and then you compute its evolution while the universe is expanding, and at some point the particle freezes out, and you're left with a relic density which you can compute reliably. Okay, so the most famous example here is the LSP, the lightest supersymmetric particle in supersymmetric theories, which have conserved R parity. And eventually, what I will discuss today is some other kind of weakly interacting particle, elementary particle, which is the lightest Kaluza-Klein particle, which can be stable under certain conditions. And I will give one example, which is in a class of models which we call models with universal extra dimensions, where the symmetry which guarantees the stability is called Kaluza-Klein parity.
What about not for model production? You could also have that is very optional.
Well, no, this is in the first class. Yeah. Well, no, actually, you can have thermal production, but it's just that the particle never reached thermal equilibrium, but you can still produce it using scattering with a thermal bath. So let me give you a list of the dark matter candidates which are on the market. I'm sorry, I've been distracted, and some part of this transparency is written in French. So if you want to practice your French, that's the opportunity. Okay, so we've seen that active neutrinos, so neutrinos from the standard model, cannot account for dark matter because this is hot dark matter. There is a possibility that a fourth generation of neutrinos, which would be sterile, could be part of the dark matter, but not to be in contradiction with structure formation, it would have to be warm dark matter, which is still acceptable with structure formation. But in this case, the mass of this particle should be in the KeV range, which is hard to motivate from particle physics. And then there is this class here. So, I mean, warm dark matter corresponds to this tiny window of masses in the KeV range. So, because if it's below KeV, it's going to be hot dark matter, and if it's above, let's say, 1 GeV, it corresponds to cold dark matter. So.
Sorry, I missed.
Yeah. Okay.
So here there is this class of weakly interacting massive particles, which corresponds to particles which interact weakly, which can be produced at thermal equilibrium. But the main point is that they have to be non-relativistic at the time of decoupling, so that they correspond to this cold dark matter category. And here we have all these possibilities from the lighter supersymmetric particles. It turns out that this neutrino is excluded because this neutrino would contribute to the width of the Z gauge boson. And there is a bound on this mass, which is from LEP, which is larger than 45 GeV. And if this neutrino has such a big mass, it would annihilate very quickly, essentially. And its relic density would be too tiny to account for dark matter.
Why is it not a weak interaction process?
Well, the thing is that it annihilates through the S channel of a zero mode Z boson, I mean a standard model particle, and therefore the annihilation cross section is very high. Okay, actually, no, it's quite an exotic possibility, but requires very low reheat temperature. So the favorite possibility is actually the neutralino. It turns out that the gravitino is also a good candidate, but it would be a nightmare for experimentalists, essentially, because it would be very hard to detect it with the usual standard techniques for searches of dark matter. There are actually indirect ways to probe these possibilities coming from cosmology, because the gravitino would decay very late because it couples gravitationally. And it could destroy the prediction of Big Bang nuclear synthesis. So there are constraints from early universe cosmology on this guy.
And it can't be the dark matter.
It could be the dark matter, yes.
How could it decay during nuclear synthesis and be the dark matter?
Well, okay. The thing is that actually it would be stable, but the next lighter supersymmetric particle would decay into this guy, but with a very long lifetime. So there's still.
What's the range of mass of gravitino that you have?
Well, so they are very. Okay. So actually, depending on the mechanism for supersymmetric breaking, you can have very different. So it could be in the TeV range, but it could also be KeV mass in the case of gauge mediation. Well, okay. And then there are these axions, which actually are cold dark. Perfect cold dark matter candidates, but in order to work, this guy must have a mass which is in the 10 minus 5 electron volt range, And if it's a QCD axion, this corresponds to a narrow window for the scale of the Petchiquin breaking of the Petchiquin symmetry. But it's still a possibility. Okay, and these are some other. Okay, so now let me concentrate on the weakly, the WIMP case, for which we can make generic predictions for the relic density. So essentially what we have to do is to solve the Boltzmann equation of this kind, which is telling us how, so n is the number density of this relic, and here, this is telling you how the density of this particle evolves with time. And there is a competition between the expansion rate of the universe and the annihilation rate of this particle. So sigma is the annihilation cross-section times v, the relative velocity of the two annihilating particles. And this is the thermal average. This is the thermal density just given by the Boltzmann factor. And what happens is that the universe is getting cooler and cooler, when the expansion rate of the universe becomes of the same order as the annihilation rate, then the particle freezes out, okay, because the particle is so diluted that it cannot find another companion to annihilate with. And at this point, the density remains constant. And so then you can, from once you have solved this equation, you can find what is the omega h squared coming from this relic. And, okay, you don't care very much about this expression. What I want to say is that it's inversely proportional to the annihilation cross-section. And usually what we do is that we expand this cross-section. We make a non-relativistic expansion. So A and B as just the first coefficient of this non-relativistic expansion. And what you have to do is to compute this coefficient. And then you have your omega h squared. So this has been done in really great details for the lightest supersymmetric particle. I mean, the calculations have reached a degree of sophistication, a high degree of sophistication. And today I would like to talk about Kaluza-Klein dark matter. So for this to work, it has to be weakly interacting from the arguments I've just gave. And this requires that Kaluza-Klein excitation should be at a TeV. Okay. And now the question is, what guarantees the stability? And I will give here an example in these models with universal extra dimensions. So why extra dimensions at a TeV? Well, do we expect new physics at a TeV just because precision measurements in the standard model points towards a light Higgs, and it's hard to maintain a light Higgs in models which do not have a cutoff scale. Sorry, in the context where the cutoff scale is not at a TeV. So it's natural to be willing to explore some non-supersymmetric new TeV physics, since the MSSM phenomenology has been explored to death. And there have been some new ideas, like this little Higgs model you probably have heard about, and this possibility of having Kaluza-Klein excitations at the TeV scale. Okay, so asking the question, why should we have extra dimensions at the TeV, is the analog of asking, why should supersymmetry be broken at the TeV scale? And we don't have any satisfying answer to this. So,
for supersymmetry, you have this dimensional transmutation type argument, right?
Well,
I think you can explain why it could be anything, but that's different than explaining why it is at a TeV, right? It's stable to put it there, but it's not the same as saying that it should be there.
Why was it stable?
Isn't it? Supersymmetry.
Well, but there is no realistic models of supersymmetry breaking, which, I mean, will tell you why supersymmetry is broken at the TeV scale. So,
you give a technically natural explanation of why Higgs and you have an extra dimension in the E?
Well, so
that's the main reason people would be.
Yeah, essentially, this is why people want to explore this you have new ingredients to break electroweak symmetry. You have, so you're just trying to play with this.
No, but it is less natural.
I'm just asking. Suppose you assume that you need the extra dimension.
Yes.
Does that give you a mechanism that technically naturally explains why the Higgs can be a TEV instead of having more spins? That's the thing you get out of.
Well, it's just that the cutoff will be, let's say, maybe at the 20 TeV, if you have extra dimensions at the TeV scale and you have gauge bosons propagating in these extra dimensions, then, I mean, the cutoff of your theory is around 20 TeV because the theory becomes strongly
coupled. So you're just saying Higgs mass is the cutoff?
Well, it doesn't.
I think that's the question. The question is the Karatvig problem. I think that there is a solution of the Karatvig problem with supersymmetry, but not with extra dimensions.
No, there is. Okay. There is a solution in the sense that you stabilize the Higgs mass, but there is no explanation why there is no explanation of why the weak scale is so much smaller than the Planck scale.
Yeah.
It just stabilizes. Okay, I understand.
But also, it's a very tiny hierarchy, is what you're saying. If you have six extra dimensions that are a TeV across, the Planck scale is tens of TeV, so it's not a very big
thing. And then the Higgs mass is only well by a factor of a few hundred or thousand.
No,
I agree. I mean, okay, so then, so we have this extra dimensions at the TeV, and so we have Kaluza-Klein excitations at the TeV. And we can explore the phenomenology of this. So the questions are, what are the constraints on what are the experimental constraints on 1 over R? So this depends essentially where the standard model fields live. So if they are localized in 4 dimensions, essentially there is no constraints on 1 over R if only gravity propagates in the extra dimensions. However, if now you allow the gauge bosons of the standard model to propagate into extra dimensions while fermions are localized at the fixed bounds of the orbifold, then you would have constraints of this type due to the fact that you have KK modes. You have three-level exchange of KK modes in this kind of diagram. The interesting thing is that if now you allow all standard model particles to propagate into extra dimensions, which I will call universal extra dimensions, then the bound is actually very weak. Like you can lower 1 over R to 300 GeV. And this is due to the fact that you have three-level conservation of the momentum along the fifth dimension. These are three-level. So this is telling you that you have conservation of Kaluza-Klein number in the interactions of the effective 4D theory, and that KK modes can only be produced by pairs. So it's difficult to produce these KK modes, and that's why the bound is so low. So now I would like to explore the possibility of KK dark matter in this context. And I will illustrate this in the context of this universal extra dimensions. So there are different possibilities. The lightest Kaluza-Klein particle is a KK photon or a KK neutrino, or it could be a KK graviton. And you want to compute what is the relic density of these guys. So I will do a calculation in 5D. You can generalize it to 6D easily. And then I will talk about the detection issues.
Excuse me, the bound you're giving on the universal extra dimensions, was coming from the direct production or? Also from the precision test.
Precision test,
okay. Yes. Because that's the precision test where the argument is not obvious, you could produce a blue loop.
Yes, that's true.
So why is it that it's still so small?
Well, so first from collider. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's the collider constraints. And then you have violation of KK number at loop level. Mm-hmm. But still, you have conservation of KK parity. So this is what I want to talk about. So that you can only have interactions Okay, so let me take on that. Well, a few motivations for this model with universal extra dimensions. This is non-supersymmetry. So since if you have gauge bosons in the bulk, then you will have quickly strong dynamics, okay, in the bulk, and this can lead to some dynamical electroweak symmetry breaking mechanism. For instance, you can have the Higgs as a bound state at the top with its KK modes, and these are bounded by KK modes of the gluon. In the case of two extra dimensions, this also does argue that you can explain the number of fermion generations from anharmonic cancellation. Again, in the case of two extra dimensions, you can guarantee proton stability. So if the cutoff is around 20 TeV, you would say, okay, I can write higher dimensional operators which are suppressed only by the TeV scale, so this would be dangerous. So here's the idea is that if you have two extra dimensions, you will have some symmetry which is a remnant of the rotation in the X5, X6 plane. And you can assign charges to standard model particles in such a way that there is essentially no operators which violate proton, which violate baryon number up to dimension 15 operators actually.
So become universal extra dimensions, everything.
Yes, so extra dimensions is all the standard model. So it's traditional Kaluza-Klein, like, if
no,
you want.
No grains?
No. So I just compactify on an orbifold in order to have a chiral theory, but everybody propagates into the extra dimensions.
How general are this?
So this is for if you have two extra dimensions, these two cases. But this is generic.
What is that for? Model dependent on the semi?
Yes.
What is general?
So here for well, it's so this is an argument from anomaly cancellation. I couldn't tell you exactly what do you want to know more.
So he predicts or they predict?
Well, it's modulo 3 or something. But well, we can discuss this. Okay, so what is important for us is the stability of the lightest Kaluza-Klein particle. So this is related to this Kaluza-Klein parity, which is a discrete symmetry and a remnant from invariance under translations along the fifth dimension. So what happens is that at tree level, Kaluza-Klein number is conserved. However, it's broken by the orbifold. But there is a remnant symmetry, which is Kaluza-Klein parity, and which corresponds to minus 1 to the KK number excitation. And this is telling you, essentially, that n can change by only an even number. So let's say I take one extra dimension, so I compactify on S1 mod Z2.
Why were you calling all these things about
2
actually?
Yeah. So I would have T2 mod Z2 or mod Z4. Yeah. That's all I need to guarantee the chirality of my theory. The fact that. Okay, so in this case, you can have only interactions between an even number of odd KK modes. So, for instance, you can have n equal 2, interact with 2, n equal 1, or this kind of diagrams. So n equal 2 can decay into n equal 0, but you cannot have the decay of n equal 1 into n equal 0, which corresponds to the standard model particles, which are identified with the zero mode. So therefore, the lightest Kaluza-Klein particle is stable. And this is also the reason why, as I was saying, that the first KK modes can only be produced by pair. is an imaging you produce at LHC, this KK mode.
That is already in the orbital or before you do the orbital? I mean, before you do the orbital, this is obvious, but I mean, it's clear. Mm-hmm. So it's also valid to say when you do the orbital.
Yeah, the KK parity thing. Yeah, so the main point is that you need to have at the two boundary, the two orbifold fixed points, you need to have equal interactions. The Lagrangians at the two orbifold fixed points should be the same, otherwise, you will break this KK parity. So you have to make this assumption. But then you have
standard model leaves at one of these strings?
No, the standard model leave everywhere. But you can always add some localized interactions. And what I'm saying is that to have KK parity, you need to have the same Lagrangians at the boundaries.
Can you say the same Lagrangians in the fields?
The same fields and
the
same.
Fields at one plane are equal to the fields at the other plane?
That's
a very non-local constraint. You're saying that some field on the left plane is actually equal to the field, not just its quadratic, but its value of the field is the same on the left and the right.
Well, I mean, I start with when I write my 4D effective Lagrangian, I can add these Lagrangians which live on the fixed ones, and I just add the same interactions and the same. Well, I'm not sure.
You don't propose the Z2 symmetry on the field, do you?
Yeah.
On the interactions?
Yes, on the interactions.
Right, so they're distinguishing between the interactions and the Lagrangian and the value of the field, actually.
Oh, okay.
You can
spontaneously break the
Z2
around, just what's being asked. Is it okay if it's spontaneously broken?
It's an expectation value on different ends of the interval.
I think so, yeah.
You would break the parity. But it's not so crazy that the same expectation value. I mean, the Higgs has the same expectation value here and here. Right? And these are much further apart than the little tiny extra dimensions. But the fields that are everywhere, just interacting.
Well, okay, so here this was just to illustrate what kind of signal you would have if, imagine you produce these KK particles here, then what would happen is that this KK quark would decay, for instance, into a KK photon and a zero mode quark. So you would have this kind of signal where you have two jets plus missing energy, because you would not see this KK photons. Okay. So now imagine we have this Kaluza-Klein parity and we have a stable Kaluza-Klein particle. So who would be this this lightest Kaluza-Klein particle? So for phenomenological reasons, it has to be electrically neutral and non-baryonic. So the most promising candidate would be the first level KK modes of the neutral gauge bosons or of the KK neutrino. So what you have to do is you have to compute the mass eigenstates and eigenvalue of the KK photons and KKZ. So you just diagonalize the mass matrix here in the B. N is the KK mode number, and W3N. So what happened is that actually, because you have, so here is the three-level mass, just N squared over R squared. This effect is just the electroweak symmetry breaking effect. And you have these loop corrections to the masses. And the effect of this correction is that essentially here, the mass eigenstate, instead of being the usual KKZ and KK photon will be essentially a KKB. So what I want to say is that the Weinberg angle of the KK mode is essentially zero.
You should probably lift that up so that people can read.
Okay. So essentially the The LKP is approximately aligned with the KK big H boson. And the next lightest Kaluza Klein particle is likely to be a first KK excitation of the right-handed electron.
How do fermion polymers work in five dimensions? Are the fermions?
Well, they are the same as the zero mode.
The representation doesn't double in size in five dimensions, it doubles in six.
Well, but that's why you do this orbifold, because you want. So essentially, you have twice as many states.
Your Z2 is going to project out half of the fermions.
Yes. So here I'm making some, I don't know who is the lightest one. I can give some arguments, but essentially you cannot predict very reliably what would be the spectrum of the KK masses. So here is the spectrum at three levels. So imagine you have 1 over R around 500 GeV, and what leaves the degeneracy is just electroweak symmetry breaking here. Now you distort the KK tower by radiative corrections, and this has been computed by these authors. And what happens is that essentially the particles which feel the most, so the strong interactions, are lifted the most. And it's so in this spectrum, the lightest Kaluza Klein particle will be the lighter, the KK photon, because this is the one which does not receive major corrections, loop corrections, to its mass. But the determination of the spectrum depends strongly on the UV physics. So that's why I'm going to remain open, and I'm just not going to assume that the LKP is a photon, but it could also be a neutrino or something else. So then I want to compute the relic density of this guy. So let's imagine first that this LKP is this KK excitation of the big H boson. And essentially, you have to compute this annihilation cross sections. And it's very simple. You only have to compute the annihilation into fermions or into scalars. So the annihilation is via the exchange of this KK fermion here. So you do this, and once you have the annihilation cross section, you have your prediction for omega H squared. So this is omega H squared due to my KKB as a function of its mass. And this is what you would like to explain. So this gives you a prediction for the mass window of the KK particle. And as you expect, this is in the TeV range, because this particle has weak interactions. You can play the same game if the LKP is a KK neutrino. You just have a little bit more interactions. The KK neutrino can annihilate into fermions, but it can also annihilate into gauge bosons. And you get the same kind of predictions for the mass window. Well, it depends whether you have only one flavor or three flavors of KK neutrino. If the three flavors of neutrino are degenerate in mass or not. How much time do we have?
I should end around
2. And what time is it?
2:40.
Okay. So in the case of the lightest supersymmetric particle, there are very detailed calculations. And something which can really change the prediction for the relic density is what we call co-annihilation effects. So let me quickly say what it means. So this corresponds to the case where the lightest supersymmetric particle is nearly degenerate with the next lightest supersymmetric particle. So in this case, these two particles are both thermally available. So they have essentially the same number density at thermal equilibrium. So they can co-annihilate with each other, and therefore there is more room for annihilation. So the annihilation will be more efficient, and therefore you expect that the relic density will be smaller. And since at the end what you compute is rho, which is the density times the mass of the particle, if n is much smaller, then the prediction for the mass will be that you need higher masses. So here we can ask the same kind of question: what happens if the lightest Kaluza-Klein particle is nearly degenerate with the next lightest one? And in this case, you have to compute this co-annihilation channels between the KKB and the KK right electron. But actually, here the situation is different from supersymmetry, because it turns out that these co-annihilation channels are not efficient. So if you want, you start with twice as many states. You have this KKB and also this KK electron. You have the same number of zero modes, and you're left essentially with more particles, because you have not, there was essentially no co-annihilation. So the result is different, that you end with, in the case where you have nearly degenerate lightest and next to lightest Kaluza-Klein particle, you, at the end, you have more dark matter in number density. So this lowers the window for the mass, okay, and is larger, so you just need smaller masses. The main result here is that you can lower the bound on the mass to something like 600 GeV. This is for different degree of degeneracy between the LKP and the NLKP.
The mass of the particle could be lower than that, just would not be dark matter.
Sorry?
The mass of the particle could be less than that, but it would not be dark matter, right?
It would not be the major part of the dark matter.
So what if the coordination do not work in this case?
Well, so just that you started with more particles. So, you know, you start at thermal equilibrium, so n goes like e to the minus m over t. So if the two particles have the same mass, then they have the same number density. While before you were assuming that the next lightest Kaluza-Klein particle was really more massive, and you could just forget about it. But now they have both the same number density, so you have to take them into account, and you compute the annihilation of each of them. But they don't co-annihilate. So you started with more dark matter particles, and you end with more.
But why is this different from
that? In supersymmetry, the co-annihilation channels are very efficient. So they actually co-annihilate, and at the end, there is less number.
In this case, is it just that the direction rating is smaller?
Yeah. Well, it's just that the...
I just don't understand the...
Well, for instance, in supersymmetry, you would have co-annihilation between the neutralino and the stop.
Yeah.
And this would, if you complete the cross-section, it would be very high. It can be a very important effect. Here, just... Okay, another important effect is that if you consider now the six-dimensional case, you can have a different situation, because you would have, so if you compactify on T2 mod Z2, you would have four stable particles now, B1, 0, B0, 1, B1, 1, B1, minus 1. These one are much heavier, so they are Boltzmann suppressed. You can just forget about it. This guy have the same mass. So so you will have really more particles at the end. This is the same argument as I was giving in the co-annihilation section. Because of Kaluza-Klein number conservation, these two guys, they do not talk to each other. So they annihilate independently at three levels. So you start with twice as many LKP, the same number of zero modes. the Rydberg density is multiplied by a factor of 2. And since omega h squared goes like m squared, the KK mass window now is smaller by a factor square root 2. So this allows you to essentially lower the mass prediction for this KK particle. So if you compare the 5G and 6D case, you see you can. So now if you have co-annihilation in 6D, then you can actually go to masses down to 400 GeV. Okay, so now that you've checked that the LKP could have the appropriate Rydberg density to account for dark matter there, then you would like to ask questions related to detection. So these are similar to the WIMP. There are two ways. There are these direct searches where you search for the deposition of KeV recoil energy when your LKP or LSP scatters from a nucleus in a detector. And then there are these indirect searches which corresponds to the detection of cosmic rays coming from the annihilation of the dark matter particles in the center of the galaxy, or also in the center of the sun, where you have a higher density of dark matter. And it turns out that this is within the sensitivity of future kilometer cube neutrino telescopes. I don't think you want to hear too much about this. But maybe I can show you. So this is a study which was made by Cheng and collaborators. So here they show what would be the positron spectrum which come from the annihilation of this LKP in the center of the galaxy. And they have these peaks here for different KK masses. This is the background. And, well, so this is quite different from what you expect from annihilation of LSPs and the galactic center, because in the case of LSPs, you wouldn't have this peak. But this is related to the fact that, first, the Majorana nature of neutralinos versus here, we have a dark matter candidate, which is a gauge boson. And here you can annihilate into electron-positron at three levels.
And so are there any actual observations of this?
Yes, you can search for. I forgot which experiment.
Is there some limit that fits on this plot?
Oh yes. So I think right now it just can't say anything, but in the near future. Okay. So. It sounds like these indirect searches are actually more promising than the direct searches, which is to look for this KeV recoil on nucleus. And there is a major experimental program. I mean, there are more than 20 experiments to search for the elastic scattering of WIMPs with the nuclei. Let me illustrate it. So let's go back to the neutrino case. So imagine the LKP is a KK neutrino, and it could interact with a quark in a nucleus by the exchange of just a zero mode Z gauge boson. And if you compute this cross section, you find that actually the KK neutrino is excluded by direct searches. So here this is the exclusion plot. So here this is the WIMP nucleon cross section versus the WIMP mass. And these are the exclusion plots from Edelweiss, which is actually today which has the best sensitivity. And what we find is that here we predict a cross section which is in the range of 10 to the minus 3 picobaran, which is well above here, which means that the KK neutrino mass has to be larger than 50 TeV. So the KK neutrino possibility is excluded by direct searches for the same reason as the neutrino is also excluded because of this very high cross section due to the boson exchange. So now let me mention the B1 case. In this case, it's very far from being excluded. So in this case, you would you would scatter elastically through the exchange of a KK quark or through the exchange of the zero mod Higgs. And then the prediction now for this nucleon wimp cross section are now very small, and you can compare. So I don't enter into details, but when you do this kind of calculation, there are spin interactions and scalar interactions. One case, the interaction with the spin of the nucleus, and the other case, it's the interaction with the nucleon number in the nucleus. So here, if you want, we have three parameters. We have the KK mass, we have the mass splitting between this KKB and the KK quark, and there is the Higgs mass. And varying these three parameters, you get these different values for the elastic cross section. And now if you compare these numbers with what you would obtain with neutralinos, the case of neutralinos, you can get very small when you scan all the MSSM parameter space. You can get very small values. But in our case, we actually have some upper bound. And I want to just show you the experimental situation. So here, this is again this WIMP nucleon cross-section versus a WIMP mass, and all the different experiments, the different limits. So these are the existing limits, and these are the projections. And these are the predictions from the MSSM in the case of neutralino. And you see it can go very, very low. And in our case, for LKPs, we are in this bound here. And xenon, which is, I think, a one-ton detector, may be able to probe this possibility. But as I said, this direct search seems to be less promising than the indirect search. And what is actually sure is that at LHC, you will definitely be able to probe this possibility. So if there are KK modes at 20 eV, you should be able to produce them. The problem is, how will you distinguish them from supersymmetric signal? Imagine you are only able to produce the first KK mode and not all the KK tower. Then how do you distinguish between the first KK excitation and the supersymmetric partner? You have to be able to measure with very high precision the spin and the coupling of the particle. So I think I will not show this. Well, just an idea here. This is with this xenon detector I was talking about. How many events per year do you expect due to the elastic scattering of a WIMP and a detector? And here, with this detector, which is a one-ton detector, then maybe you would, so this is for LKP. So how many events per year as a function of the mass of your calcite particle? So you see, if you have more than, if the mass is larger than 700 GeV, then you won't see many events. Maybe here in this range, you will be able to see at least 10 or 20 events per year, but okay.
What is the time scale of that story?
10 years.
But at the low end, LHC may
be. Yeah, so I would say, I mean, LHC will be probably the best way to probe this idea. Okay.
Then you have to go to linear
climber to really. Yes, and then really to make sure that this is an LKP, you have to build a linear collider.
How much they
gain? Okay. Well, so the nature of dark matter is a major puzzle in particle physics and cosmology. There are various possibilities. Here I wanted to emphasize the fact that the LSP is not the only dark matter candidate which has weak interaction and which is an elementary particle. Well, the interesting thing here is that there are less parameters maybe than in the MSSM. You just essentially have 1 over R. And I gave the example where the stability of the KK particle is related to this KK parity, but I would like to generalize this idea a bit more. So for instance, we like to generalize it to warp space. So you all know this Randall syndrome setup, which offers a solution to the weak Planck scale hierarchy without supersymmetry. There are some other interesting phenomenological issues there. You have a natural way to generate large hierarchies in the Yukawa, the fermion-Yukawa couplings. Something which I didn't mention, in these models where you have flat extra dimensions at a TEV, there is a risk that the radion field has a small mass. And so this radion field would be stable. It could account for dark matter, but it could also would have an energy density which would overclose the universe. But this is, you know, it depends on the mechanism responsible for the compactification. So the idea here is that if there is no KK parity here, so what would guarantee the stability of the LKP? So what I should say first is that in this model, even if the size of the extra dimension is tiny, however, the KK spacing is TEV. So you will have KK excitations at the TEV scale. So if you have SU5 in Randall syndrome, imagine the particle which has zero modes, so the standard model particles, the carry baryon number in multiples of 1/3, while particles which do not have zero modes have baryon number 1/6 or 1/2. So their lightest Kaluza-Klein mode cannot decay into standard model particles, and therefore it can be stable. So I will end here. Thank you.
Any questions?
So if you want to learn more about interesting model building in models with TEV, so I mentioned you can discuss with Shaba and Christoph, who have a model with no Higgs. They break electric symmetry without Higgs.
So is this last thing in is your transparency good old Randall syndrome or somehow universal?
It's Randall syndrome with gauge bosons in the dark. And fermions in the bar. Everybody in the bar.
The fermions are the standard model in the bar?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I didn't.
The fermions, one of the fermions of
And why would I care about this?
Well, that was my next question. It seems to me that it might change the masses what we get next from, Wilson line around the five.
What is this?
They get an F squared term.
Okay. Yeah, well, this is just the minimum.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is the minimum should include the transcendence.
But, I mean, Okay, it would be a correction like of order one or something. But it should be in the TV, in the TV range.
So I think we agreed that we'll just give people a day off tomorrow and not have any opponents back in 1 week.
Except that some of us wouldn't be
here. Someone has something to say. Okay, well, thank you, Alina.
We'll tell you about that.